Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone. You found the Mormon Matters podcast again, and we're so glad that you've joined us. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I am so excited to have this conversation. This is a conversation I've been wanting to have for several months. One of my guests, Matt Knockleby, and I have been having a great year-long sort of whenever we get together or through online things and things like that. We get talking about science and religion and their respective roles and why one should take precedence in one area and the other in another. And I'm just really thrilled that he could do it today. This is right in the week that he's about to defend his doctoral dissertation, things like that. But I wanted to have this conversation, especially here on the heels of the Brian Dalton, Mr. Deity episode that we had last week, where there was a lot of things said in his argument about science and it should take precedent and religion is really the drag on human progress and things like that. And so it's just time to really hammer out science and religion and what the two things are. And so besides Matt, we've brought Steve Peck on, who we've had on the show a couple of times before. He's just one of those wonderful, outgoing, bright, engaging voices in Mormonism. Steve, would you mind reintroducing yourself to the Mormon Matters listeners, a little bit about your background?
Oh, I'd be glad to. I'm an evolutionary ecologist at BYU. I teach history and philosophy of biology and bioethics. I love science. I mean, I love science. And so this is one of my favorite topics. I love talking about it. I love especially engaging it in the sense of trying to understand the role of religion and science together, because both are vital and important parts of my life. So glad to do this. I spend most of my time, oddly enough, arguing that science is okay in the light of religion. So I've seen a growing tendency to dismiss science, its findings, for members of the church. And so I'm championing the idea that science plays a vital role in any intellectual undertaking, including our faith. And so that's my background.
Well, Steve, you are great at what you just say that you love doing. And so we're so thrilled to have you. So appreciate you coming back very, very much. Matt, I did a really terrible minor allusion to you and what you're up to in your life there. Fill us in.
Sure. Thanks. It's great to be here. I am a PhD candidate, at Rice University. My degree is in electrical engineering. I'm defending my thesis in less than 2 weeks. And my background is, I was raised Mormon. Actually, I am an ex-Mormon atheist. And I think I have the exact opposite problem of Stephen, which is that I find myself among fellow secularists arguing that science is something other than the perfect, pristine institution of objectivity that a lot of people like to make it out to be. And so I think we might be arguing somewhat ironic points, whereas Steve wants to champion science and I want to emphasize its humanity.
I like it. Plus, we got you guys on representing the age-old debate of, is science or engineering the true discipline?
It's funny because when I tell people I'm an engineer, I think they usually get the wrong idea, especially in electrical engineering. They tend to see, or they tend to imagine somebody who is, you know, working with circuits and soldering irons and something like that. And my research, at least, is on very much on the theoretical side. So I like to think of myself as more of a mathematician than an engineer, at least an applied mathematician. But on the other hand, I don't want to misrepresent myself because none of my degrees are in mathematics. So I never quite know how to label myself for people who want to know what I do.
Well, all I know is every time you talk, you make a lot of sense to me. So I'm really grateful to have you. And just one quick other thing. So with this defense that's coming up and you'll have your doctorate, where are you headed next?
I have accepted a postdoctoral fellowship at Duke
Cool, North
in
Carolina.
Durham. Yeah, we're my wife and I are very excited to move. We're in Houston now, which is not where we want to be, and North Carolina is more where we want to be. And so I'll be there for a couple years while I look for tenure track faculty positions.
Oh, I'm so envious. I worked 2 years at Duke, and I just love the whole area. I did my doctorate in NC State, so North Carolina is like Shangri-La to me. So congratulations on not only finishing your doctorate, but landing in a magical world.
Thanks.
Yeah, don't they call like Duke, North Carolina, is it some kind of triangle? What's the word they use?
Yeah, triangle. There's so much going on there. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, terrific place. I remember when I was at Claremont, it was just so wonderful because I could catch a lecture at UCLA, USC, University of Redlands. It's just so fun to be around neat places with each of them have their own money to bring really amazing speakers.
It's true. At NC State, I could take classes at Duke or UNC, both just a wonderful place. So well done.
Thank you.
Well, guys, I'm so thrilled to have you, and we did pre-circulate some conversation the last few days, so I think we landed with, let's talk about the beauty and the wonder and the power of science first, and why it is such an attractive and an important tool and things like that. So, Steve, do you mind taking the lead, as we discussed, and just riffing however you want on all the things you love about science?
Sure, and feel free to chime in if I'm not being clear or if you feel like you want to elaborate on things. You, Matt, too, if I'm missing the boat completely, feel free to jump in and point things out. The question of what is science is so complex and so fraught with sort of the baggage we carry with it from popular culture and things. It's good to step back and maybe get a sense of what it is, because we use it as a shorthand. We say things like science says or science does this, as if it were a single monolithic entity that was moving forward in certain ways. And it's more messy and more complex than I think most people realize. And so let me just start by kind of giving a brief outline of some of science's activities. And you see what I just did there? I just used it like it was a monolithic.
Right. So with all the qualifications in place, we're going to talk like this.
But we talk like this, and we mean things by that. I think we mean appropriate things. And so this is sort of my shorthand version of it. And this allows me then to actually talk about appropriate science and what the difference between appropriate science is, inappropriate science, and appropriate and inappropriate uses of science. Because I find all over the place, science becomes whatever people want it to be to make a point. And so let me just start with kind of an outline. And I wish I had a chart that I could draw this out on. But I think the first point I want to make about science is that it's a commitment to a set of values. Science doesn't create these values. They're not scientifically derived or investigated, but they form the substrate on which science exists. And so let me talk about those values first. The values that science aims for, the kinds of things science is going to accomplish are things like truth, explanatory simplicity, objectivity, repeatability, predictability, knowledge. All these kinds of things are aims of science that we want to achieve. The overall aim of science, just loosely put, is to understand the world. If science can be summed up to anything, it's the search for the way the world works. And that can take on all kinds of complexity, but let's just start it there. So given these values, truth and simplicity, trying to understand the world, beyond that, now we can start to sort of construct what goes on top of that set of values that science embraces. Okay, so we'll start with a framework for proceeding. What are the tools of science? The main tools are, in fact, rational discourse, logic, the use of theory, That's a complex term, but I'll explain it if we need it more. But falsifiable hypotheses, making statements that can be tested against the world. Pluralism is a part of science, looking for multiple explanations, openness to revision, holding the results as tentative. That's one of the main strengths of science. It has to be kept in mind. When I talk to people who complain that science has always changed its mind, it's yes, that's why it's so strong. It always reevaluates its findings in light of new information and new analyses. That's part of what makes it so great. Then on top of that set of procedures, sort of commitments to the way that we work science. So we take careful measurements. We use experimentation. We try to reduce the world to something we can handle and do experiments on the questions we're asking. We replicate those experiments. We use observations and controls. We use modeling, statistical analyses. We have rules about lab procedures. We train students in lab procedures. All of that goes into what makes science so powerful. And then finally, there's a set of social structures that are absolutely important to science. These act in a sense of a check and a balance on what we're doing. Scientists don't work in the dark. They might work in the dark for a while, but eventually their research has to be exposed to the light of scrutiny. We have lots of things for that. Granting agencies, most important, and let me emphasize this, peer review. Peer review is where the papers are examined by other experts in the field who look at your methodology, who look at your analysis, who look at what you've done, maybe even try to repeat it if it's possible. But in that peer review, a lot gets sorted out about whether this is worthy or not to go forward. And so there's also licensing, accreditation, funding, journals. Journals are the way that science gets communicated. Science doesn't just get to jump in front of reporters and say, this is what we just discovered. They do that from time to time, and it's almost always a disaster. It has to be reported. It has to go through the peer review process and then published in a journal so that it's completely accessible. One of the other hallmarks of science is that it is laid out what you did so that others can repeat it, and then it's published in journals. If you have preliminary work, you present it in conferences to get ideas on where to head. The university system itself is one of the most important aspects of science, where students are trained, funding is arranged, and discussions continue at that level. All of these things. Okay, so I've outlined sort of what science values, a framework that they're working under, a set of procedures that they engage in, and then some social structures that have been put in place to ensure the quality and the continuing quality of the product, which is knowledge about the world. One of the things I think that most people don't realize is an aspect of science that's absolutely vital is the assumption of methodological materialism, okay? Methodological materialism is the way that science has to proceed. And you hear the word materialism a lot of times. A lot of people that I know that aren't that familiar with science get very frightened of the word materialism, and I'll explain why in just a second.
Why would people be afraid of materialism? I mean, don't we all want to be like Madonna and live in a material world and be a material girl?
Exactly.
But I'm guessing what you're reading by materialism, it's just referring to matter, right?
Right. And I need to make a quick distinction here about what I mean. When I say methodological materialism, it is an assumption about the things that science studies. Okay, this often gets co-opted by some people to become an ontological materialism. Ontological materialism is the idea that matter is all there is, and everything that happens is in fact matter. That's a metaphysical claim. But methodological materialism is just the working sort of assumption that we have to do. But everybody's familiar with this. This is not this shouldn't be earth-shattering because we're all methodological materialists, like when it comes to our car. When my car breaks down and I go to the mechanic, I expect him to find material causes for why it's not working. And if he came back to me and said, you know, Steve, I really think the reason your car broke down is that you're just not holding family home evening. I'd say, maybe not, but find the material cause. I mean, we look to our car mechanics to be full out methodological materialists. If they came back and told us we've got a configuration of fairies in there messing things up, we'd do mechanic. We're absolute, when it comes to our cars, we're absolute methodological materialists. And the scientists are the exact same way. We're not looking for other causes or some sort of hidden force. The assumption is that what we're working with can be explained by causal forces in matter. And so, you know, as a religious person, you don't need to be afraid of science commitment to methodological materialism. It's an absolute necessity for science. It's the underlying assumption, and we all work with it. It's just that the word carries enough scary baggage that people become frightened when they hear, oh, materialism, that's bad.
Yeah, awesome.
The last thing about science that needs to be kept in mind is absolutely a human enterprise. And all the weaknesses that humans have, the biases, their weakness, their anything that you can find in a human is going to be in science. The strength of science is that you've got lots of eyes on this. And with lots of eyes on the results, the reporting, it tends to do well. And the proof is in the pudding. The advances that we've made in science are phenomenal. The advances that we continue to make are phenomenal. Our understanding of the world is so much more deeper that there really is this sort of progressive march to learning more and more and more. So that's my sort of diatribe on what science is. It's complex, it's transparent, and it does an amazing job of elucidating the material world.
Great. And Matt, I know there's some openings in there for you, and the one that I'm going to suggest first and then go wherever you want after that was when Steve made the distinction between methodological materialism and ontological materialism. And Steve says we shouldn't be afraid, if we're a religious person, of the methodological materialism. The move to the ontological materialism would be the person that says the material world isn't embedded in a world of spirit, or there is no other depths to it, or something like that. Whereas at least the religious person might, I'm not sure how I really say that.
Right,
there.
Right, right.
It's like totalizing it to just the material, whereas most religions and the perennial philosophy and the various things that you find out there is like there's a world of matter, there's a world of spirit, a world of mind, a world of causal,
right,
realms and stuff. So go ahead and jump in.
Yeah, excuse me. As Stephen was making the distinction, I was expecting him to sort of try to knock down ontological materialism. And as an atheist, I am more or less an ontological materialist. And I want to stick up for that mindset, at least from my perspective. I see, and I think a lot of other people who are both scientists and atheists see it this way, the extraordinary success of methodological materialism. They say, maybe the reason that methodological materialism has been so successful is that, in fact, the world is simply material. That is to say that ontological materialism is true. And so every so often you'll hear ontological materialism expressed as it's a statement of faith. Now, it's certainly a metaphysical claim. I don't dispute that even slightly. It's a metaphysical claim. But I contend that it's a metaphysical claim that is essentially a good induction. That's to say, look at how successful materialism has been everywhere else. Is it unreasonable, therefore, to infer that materialism is true throughout the universe? And I say no, although, of course, it's not certain.
Right. But then you would also allow, for instance, the non-material, you know, realms of imaginary numbers and, you know, things that are only accessed mentally and things like that to be part of this, whatever the materialism that is the universe, those things kind of have a true place within them.
We could get into a very long conversation about the philosophy of mathematics that I think you probably want to avoid. But I will. So okay. As an electrical engineer, I'm going to do an aside that's important. Complex numbers, imaginary numbers are something that I'm on a first name basis with. Basically, every day I encounter the square root of negative one. And imaginary numbers are no more imaginary than any other number. In fact, I consider all of mathematics to be a particularly useful human construct. And so for me...
So how does that fit into a materialism, if you were going to say ontological materialism?
I guess what I'm saying is I don't consider our ideas to be anything separate from the material world. I'm not trying to knock down this distinction because I think this distinction is important, and I understand why plenty of religious people are happy to make this distinction and say, well, okay, when I'm doing science, I do science as a materialist, but in my day-to-day life or in areas where empiricism is not as strong or not, or places where empiricism can't probe quite so deeply, I feel free to continue believing in religious things. And I'm perfectly comfortable with that.
For me, when you throw religion as the term there, you know, it implies for so many people the concept of God or something like that. To me, it's more like the connective tissue of the universe or something that you're sort of getting at, that, you know, when you reduce and you test for and things like that, it seems like there's somewhat of a breakdown here. And so I'm more interested in if you're going to claim ontological materialism that also includes the relationships between everything.
I think, and Stephen might chime in here, I think this depends on precisely how you define materialism and you know, so is everything matter? Does it play into that? Yes. Do the interactions as described by, you know, our best understanding of natural laws play in there? Yes, I would say. And so I don't necessarily find any – it depends on precisely the nature of the claims that you're talking about.
Yeah, and there's sort of a naive sense that matter is dead and lifeless.
Precisely, and there's no particular reason
for that, yeah.
When I say that I don't believe in anything other than the material realm – I just mean precisely that. I think that everything, including life, including energy, including connections between people, I don't see anything particularly supernatural or non, although the term supernatural, I'm sure, is fraught, as you're probably about to point out.
Yeah, no, and we'll get into that later, and especially one of the things I didn't really tease at the beginning of this, after we kind of just talk about science and its realm and its practices and all that stuff, and, you know, we'll talk about the proper interaction with it and spirituality or religion or whatever, we are going to do a section on Mormonism, and I think we can kind of, let's kind of save the natural, supernatural for
sure,
that.
Sure, let's okay. Do, yes.
Good,
yes.
Sounds good. So what else would you want to say, you know, reacting to Stephen's basic, you know, strengths, weaknesses, the importance of the social structures, the importance of, you know, the self-correcting nature of science, et cetera. Is there anything in that those realms that you want to champion too?
Yeah, a few things I want to say, and I think this is going as predicted, which is that Steve's trying to convince religious people that science is powerful, and I find a lot of people running in secular communities who want to fetishize the scientific institution, for lack of a better word. And in general, something I hear a lot is that science is merely observation. We have this very straightforward view of the scientific method, which is that you propose a hypothesis, you test that hypothesis by experiment, confirm the hypothesis, it sticks around. If they falsify the hypothesis is discarded, and that's all there is to it. And I think that is a good model for how we'd like to do science. But in practice, science can't just be as simple as this. It's not merely observation. There's, you know, 100 years of argument in the philosophy of science about how exactly to solve these problems. And I don't know that anybody is really happy with any of the solutions. But there's two big problems that I'll point out, which is one, that when we do an experiment, we test a variety of propositions instead of a single one. And two, most experiments fail. And so let me talk about the first one. Whenever we run an experiment, we try as best as we can in science to do controls and to isolate variables, et cetera, but there's not much you can do about the fact that there are multiple assumptions that have to obtain in order to make an experiment make sense. And so when an experiment fails, when an experiment gives you results that are contradictory to the hypothesis you have, there are a lot of propositions that you could choose to disbelieve in. For example, to make this concrete, with global warming, there's a bunch of data, and to my eyes, the data is rather straightforwardly indicative that there is global warming. Human activity is responsible for at least a very large fraction of it, etc. But it's always possible to say, there's something wrong with the data. There's something wrong with the scientists. There's an alternative explanation. It's always possible to rearrange the propositions that you think are falsified to protect the one that you want to believe in.
That's right.
And so the challenge of science, and this is, I think, what the scientific enterprise does particularly well, but the difficulty of science is to figure out how to manage that problem. How do you decide which propositions are the ones that ought to be discarded or revised and which ones ought to be protected? And so if you believe Thomas Kuhn, who 50 years ago wrote The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, he argues that science basically succeeds by balancing protection of the mainstream assumptions and a willingness to revise those assumptions as enough contrary evidence comes in. And so you get scientists who are trying to maintain the status quo, at least in terms of the overarching assumptions. But eventually, if enough contrary data comes in, then they're willing to revise the overarching assumptions or the paradigm.
Yeah.
Yes, you want to use the technical term. And this is necessary. Like, people will often point to this and they'll read Thomas Kuhn and say, therefore science is bad and human and doing things wrong. And I don't think that's the right read of this. What that means is that balance is necessary. So this brings you to point two, which is that most experiments fail. So if every time an experiment contradicted the expected hypothesis or contradicted the paradigm, we tore down the paradigm and said we had to start over, science would grind to a very quick and very unproductive halt. And so Stephen could probably comment on this more credibly. I'm not an experimentalist, but even in my day-to-day research, I will, prove a theorem about something, and then I'll run some code that does a numerical evaluation of the results that I think that I've proven, and it'll come out wrong. And so I have to say, all right, well, did I make a mistake in proving my theorem? Well, this has been checked over. Maybe it's even been through peer review. Or did I have something wrong in my code? Or is there something wrong with the assumptions that are used to write my code that don't pertain to my theorem? And so it's very difficult. And if every time we got a mistake, we just sort of threw it all out and said start all over, science wouldn't be able to proceed.
Good.
That is a really important point. Some of the early thinking in science, especially around the early 20th century, was a view that discounted that idea that you'd set up strong hypotheses, and then if the experiment failed, you'd go on to a new experiment. But you hardly ever know why it failed. It could be that the lamp wasn't turned on right, or your instruments weren't calibrated, or you weren't thinking of this or that. So all these alternative hypotheses, or as they call them, ancillary hypotheses, could be one of the reasons. And you have to go back and try and use what you know about the system to reconstruct it.
Great. Now, is there anything, and Matt, have you go any more positive points? Is there anything you would want to do to sort of come back to Matt on the ontological materialism? Was there anything that he framed too rough a way, or something that missed a piece that you like to always emphasize?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is actually in some ways kind of part of the heart of some of the deeper religious suspicions about science or about atheism. And I can just tell you my perspective. I appreciate Matt's perspective. Actually, I have a lot of friends who hold the exact same position. We can do science together, and we can, for some of them, we actually do religion together in a certain sense, obviously redefining things a little bit. I'm always suspicious, and this is in part because I'm a scientist, I'm always suspicious of metaphysical claims, because metaphysical claims are always untestable. It's the definitions, you can't do science on that claim. It's an assumption. And we're starting to see, and this is an active area of research for me, but I want to approach this from two sides. We live in a very strange universe with things that we don't really understand, or maybe we can't even understand, in the sense of emerging complexity. One of the assumptions of science is that by studying the pieces, we're going to get to the whole. There are hints now, coming especially in developmental biology and ecology, that we need to study complexity as complexity, that by reducing it and studying the parts, we miss the entire thing. And so I'm actively writing in philosophy of science about the use of simulation. It's an arrogance, I think, in humans to think that our brains will always be able to handle the complexity that the universe throws at us. And there's an open question. Is the universe so strange that maybe with the size of our brains and the size of our computers, there are questions that we can't ask that don't appear? And it looks like, and this is kind of a strange view of the materialism, but materialism has a flavor of kind of a bottom-up world where everything is matter. But there's also this sense that there could be feedbacks that affect the matter in ways that we really can't get to scientifically. We're starting to look at complexity. And let me... So there's that. I mean, I'm very interested in object philosophy. And as I look at the definition of objects, they're sometimes made of matter, but sometimes they're not. Sometimes things like a relationship between two people or a network of certain types has to be taken as an object in and of itself, even though underneath their supervening matter, that matter is a trivial part of the complexity that emerges in the universe. The other suspicion I have about metaphysics is this perplexing sense of first-person perspective that really just doesn't make sense from a strict materialism, and I'll speak to that. I mean, it's certainly something that can be studied. Let me start with Jackson's thought experiment, if that's okay. Fred Jackson comes up with this great thought experiment. And he stipulates right up front, this is a future neurobiologist named Mary. And by stipulation, she knows everything that the brain does in seeing the color red. So she understands the neurology of sight. She knows what happens the second the photons strike the retina. She understands how the nerves propagate down the thing. She understands perfectly how it's processed in the visual cortex and how that's sent up to consciousness. She understands absolutely all of the science. There's nothing Mary doesn't know about the visual processing of the color red. Here's the twist. Mary is colorblind. She's never seen the color red. She has no experience of red. And so the question that Frank Jackson asked is that at some point, her visual system is repaired for the first time in her life. She understands intellectually the science behind seeing the color red perfectly, okay, by stipulation. There's nothing she doesn't understand about it. And he asks the question, when they repair her eye and for the first time sees the color red, is it likely that she'll say, ah, just as I expected, I knew that's what it would, what my experience would be. Or did she learn something new that she didn't know by seeing the color red for the first time? I mean, our intuition is there would be no way for her to get a handle on what that experience was like just by knowing the neurology. So he suggests that she does learn something new. Her experience of the color red is completely outside of the material fact of the brain. Even though she understands all the science is possible, future neurobiologist, the experience of the red is something added to that materialism, if you will. He's pointing out that metaphysical or ontological metaphysics fails in the case of the experience of Quela. And then, of course, that bubbles up into the idea of consciousness. There's a deep sense that first-person access to experience to the world is unavailable and will always be unavailable. Some of the philosophers of consciousness try to imagine what kind of machine might exist in the future that could pick us up and say, this person is having a first-person experience. This isn't, it'll go up the chain of being, earthworm, not the machine says no. We're up to rats. Okay, yeah, they're having an experience. There seems to be a fundamental dichotomy between the ability to engage in first-person experience and the material world. There's just this kind of disconnect. And lots been made of that. I don't want to jump back into Descartes and go that route. But I do suggest that it gives us a suspicion that that ontological materialism may be wrong.
So my response to that would be, I would summarize that succinctly as you're saying, any metaphysical claim is going to be untestable. Therefore, there's reason to be suspicious that you have come to the right conclusion. And whether we bring up things like consciousness or just the nature of experience in general, with the counterexamples you brought up, I'd
soften that a bit. I'm not coming to a conclusion for those that materialism is wrong. I'm coming to the conclusion that there are suspicions yet to be held about the assumption of ontological materialism. I'm not concluding. I'm not using it as evidence. This is the way I'd say it. I'm not using it as evidence the materialism, but it's a suspicion that there's more to the universe than materialism allows. And at some point, we need to talk a little bit about materialism. Mormons have this really weird relationship with materialism in that we are materialists in a weird way. But we can come back to that. But go.
So my position is that, although there are difficulties in particular, I agree that I am sort of drawing conclusions on metaphysical things that I can't necessarily test explicitly. However, I feel like I have to hang my hat somewhere. And so I could simply remain completely and purely agnostic as to any sort of metaphysical claim. But I think in practice, we have to make assumptions. We have to come to conclusions. And although I will admit that the basis on which I come to my conclusion can be deconstructed or could be shown to be based on premises that are assumed rather than derived or inferred, I am still justified. I'm still relatively well-founded in coming to this conclusion, particularly so long as I hold it tentatively.
Right. Good.
And so in that, do you see a way science can ever touch experience, first-person experience?
So do I think that? So do I subscribe to sort of a Sam Harris sort of view where eventually our neural imaging will be such that we can, solve all of the problems of consciousness or ethics or whatever? I don't necessarily hold to that view. I think that would be nice. But I'm very comfortable saying science has these limitations and maybe we will surmount some of them, probably others we won't, while still saying in spite of those limitations, I am relatively comfortable coming to conclusions.
Okay.
Again, they're tentative conclusions. I'm not claiming to know with any sort of certainty or objectivity or even to the point where I've prescribed to other people what they ought to believe. Instead, I'm saying this is a sufficiently well-justified conclusion that I feel comfortable holding it, particularly at least for the time being. And honestly, since this is a metaphysical place where empiricism, at least at present, is not able to make much headway, it's on the other hand not very likely that there's going to be a whole lot of evidence that's going to push any of us in any particular direction. So I think that why we come to these conclusions has to do with something other than evidence. But that's probably something further down the pipe.
You guys, I'm really excited about this discussion, and it's entertaining the heck out of me. But I think you both have sort of made your point. And I don't know, is it fair to say something like this? Very broad view of what materialism means for both of you, but especially you for Matt, because you were able to share with us, you know, the interrelationships and Steve, you were always constantly back pointing towards wholenesses and complex systems and, you know, science at some point, you know, really can't, you know, it wants to deal with those as an object in and of themselves, and yet science is better at pulling down to the minimums and not dealing with holes. So is that fair to both of you guys that I'm kind of saying that materialism is very broad for you? Where would you guys in 1 minute say your differences are on the rest?
Yeah, how I would summarize it is, yeah, this distinction turns on exactly how narrowly or broadly you define materialism. So I agree that there are problems of consciousness or qualia that are difficult to understand. And the question I would ask is, we agree that these interconnections are here and that they are an important part of describing the phenomena that are actually occurring. Are those interactions mediated by something that is convincingly described as materialist or not? And I would be inclined to say there's no reason to suspect that it's not the former.
Cool. Steve?
I'd quibble a bit and say that I think that there is not enough reasons to embrace a metaphysical ontology, that there are things that don't fit in it, and that Matt said something I think important a little bit ago. He mentioned that he had grown comfortable enough to accept ontological materialism, but there were other factors that went into that decision, and I think that's right. I think I'd just like to say that anytime we embrace a metaphysics, it has to be extra scientific reasons. I mean, it turns out it may be useful, or it may be the way that the world seems to us. But for me, I think an ontological materialism isn't warranted based on just some of the other things that I think about the universe. And so I agree. I mean, I think Matt's position is straightforward, and I could see myself making that if it wasn't for certain other experiences that I've had that lead me to believe that the universe is richer than that.
Or, Steve, would it be something more like this? You've had these experiences that lead you to say that, and you could almost say, well, perhaps materialism could eventually get there, but yet right now the tools of religion or the language of metaphor or poetic approaches or, you know, meditative quieting all the logic and the rationality and the filters that, you know, are so active in science, they're not helping me explore those richer things, at least right yet, whether you know, eventually, like Matt would suggest, we might have that ability to explain them all with materialists.
I think, you know, we'll always have the ability with science to try to take a stab at matter in motion. And to the extent that things like art and religion and literature are, conditioned on things on the page, there may be an argument there that it's all matter all the way down. But what I think I disagree with is that those levels of engagement don't create something new above and beyond just the material substrate that they're based on. And I think this gets at also the idea of Mormonism's view of materialism is sort of just a claim that there are material things that we haven't really figured out yet or that we've seen. I mean, and science is okay with that. I mean, dark matter appeared 10 years ago, and that's, you know, I don't think Matt's materialism doesn't exclude new kinds of materialism or the emergence of discovery of,
yes,
of materials that we haven't seen. I sometimes hear religious people act like materialists are locked into the material we have available now. And I've never met a materialist that didn't actually say, no, if we start detecting it and it enters into the world of science, I'm all on board on that. But for me, when I talk about the different levels of existence, I talk about complexity and things. I think some of these higher ideas like art and literature that can't be analyzed with science are real. I mean, I write fiction, and I think fiction tells us truths that science can't tell us. And so for me, the temptation with materialism is also related to the temptation that science is going to explain everything. And I don't think science is a good explanation for literature or for art or for religion. That these things are, in fact, real parts of existence that engage in ways that are different from science and different from just a sort of bubbling up from physics in ways that I would be hesitant to call something like literature based in materialism, even though I understand that, of course, it supervenes on a material world, but that our engagement with that or our understanding of that kind of reality is a kind of ontology that emerges above just the straight sort of materialism. Does that even make any sense?
Yeah, I think that gets at the heart of the distinction between our two views, because I am absolutely in agreement that empirical scientific methods aren't going to do a very good job of explaining our engagement with the aesthetic in general, with art, with literature, science, with music. And I think where we disagree is whether or not that says anything ontologically.
Yeah, I'm sort of immersing myself in this speculative metaphysics that's coming out of sort of object-oriented philosophy that takes as a metaphysics just objects as such, whether they're material or not. I mean, the postal service as it runs is an object, and that there's some advantage in looking at ontologies that are not just material ontologies. And for me, and you mentioned this, Matt, it was materialism attracted you for various reasons that aren't necertainly scientific or
certainly,
but
yeah,
seem to work. And I like that. And this kind of ontology I find appealing for some of the same reasons. I'm in the midst of investigating it. And so my take would be, I'm suspicious enough of materialism to not want to embrace it or even use it as a working hypothesis, because for the things that I engage with, I might miss things. And so I'm suspicious that I'm ready to embrace any particular physical ontology yet, because I find I need the richness of consciousness, of first person perspective, of the things that bubble up from that, like art and literature, that I'm reluctant to embrace that kind of materialism. Even though I I'm not saying I understand, Matt, that
yes,
for you, materialism isn't denying literature or the opportunity for that to bubble up. So
good. I think we understand each other fairly well at this point.
I don't think it's an incoherent way to view the world, is what I'm saying.
Right, and I feel similarly going across the aisle. Yes.
Okay. Well, yeah. I want to jump in now with what traditionally. Okay. Well, you know what, Steve? There's one more area that I just want you to quickly distinguish. You wrote a very good blog post at By Common Consent a year or so ago, and among the things, you talked about a lot of the things that you already talked about today. But among the things that you said, and this is where we're about to move into religion and philosophy invading science and things like that. You said that there's lots of ideas out there that want to sort of capitalize on the aura of science, and yet you want to make sure that some things are, that science is sort of a category that gets protected. And you said things like, if somebody says this is true science or real science, then they're probably about to tell you something that isn't. You know, do you want to quickly just kind of do a minute on just protecting the word science and just helping us be more careful?
Okay, so yeah, in some of the blogosphere world where people are dismissing science, what they tend to do is they want to dismiss the kind of science that I do. And they do that by saying that it's not true science. So anytime you hear the word true in front of science, get ready to confront non-science, has been my experience. So, for example, a lot of times creationists will say things like, oh, I believe in microevolution, but not macroevolution. So the equivalent of saying, I believe in inches, but not miles, in my view. But what they do is they say, because evolution is not an experimental science, I can't put it in the test tube, that it falls outside the realm of science, which is ridiculous, of course. That would also dismiss geology and astronomy and things they never seem to have a problem with.
Maybe a little problem with geology in that creation. No.
Yeah.
No,
yeah,
or at least in certain parts of it. I'm just teasing.
Yeah, that's probably true. But it's a very depauperate view of science, I think. I mean, as we outline this complex process with checks and balance and peer review and measurement and openness and all the wild complexity that goes into science, what they're doing is they have what I call a school kid's view of science. Matt articulated just a second ago. He said, you know, find a hypothesis, test the hypothesis, accept or reject the hypothesis, and then go back to the drawing board if it fails. And you know, and Matt did a good job of dismissing that view, but that's a very common view. If I can't put it in a test tube, then it's not science, and it becomes useful for dismissing things that you don't want to believe in, you know, like evolution or something like that.
Okay, what about things that, you know, someone will say, well, this is on the cutting edge, or this is sort of out in front of it. Do you hate it when, is it fair ever, either of you, for somebody to say, well, this sort of rings with a sensibility that seems to be emerging in science, so at least you're not, you know, I guess this is probably, I'm asking this because this is what I tend to do, you know, so, you know, I tend to, you know, I'm a dabbler, I'm quite, you know, I'm paying attention to all the big stuff, and I certainly have, you know, a shelf here with 100 different books on science and various things. So I feel like I'm, you know, for somebody who doesn't control the math or who isn't actively working in it, I have a sense of some of the possibilities that science seems to be suggesting or things that aren't quite yet proven. Do you hate it when people start to say that kind of rings similar, or is that just even unfair?
I don't have a problem with that, as long as it's based on science that's, you know, mainstream, peer reviewed, because science is a growing thing. I mean, it's dynamic. It's always changing in the sense to give us a better view of the world. And science, and the trick there is to hold those kinds of emerging things as tentative and say, I'm gonna watch that and follow it in the literature and see whether it bears fruit or not. Because the one thing that I think I wish I could get across to people is these things that are doubtful or suspicious in their minds, it's going to be science itself that figures it out. It's not going to be people on the talk radio shows dismissing it, or, you know, something like the Heartland Institute picking apart graphs that they don't understand. And just as a quick aside, I think global warming is a good example of how in my own life, that very thing you're talking about. Back in 93, I went to a meeting with the Statistical Society, and there are lots of people from the Oceanic Society. And at that time, global warming being anthropologically caused was in dispute. And just talking to people there, about half of the people believed in it and half of the people didn't. And that's because the data was just beginning to come in. as stronger and stronger studies came in, as we began to get ecological studies as well as atmospheric studies, as we began to see oceanic studies all converging to the same story, the evidence became stronger and stronger, and my ability to pick out the way to bet became stronger and stronger. And see, and this is let me just make one quick point. Science is always open, and all its results are held tentatively, okay? Any new data, any new analysis can overturn things. But science gives you how to bet. And as things, as the odds improve for a particular story, dismissing that story becomes like a foolish gambler. I mean, if you're a gambler and, you know, somebody's flipping an untrue coin that comes up heads 95% of the time, you're going to be a really poor gambler if, despite the evidence that it's that 95% of the times it's heads, you keep bidding tails because I can't be certain. You can never be certain. So I'm going to assume it's a 50-50 all along the way, which is what people seem to be doing with a lot of science. Science doesn't have the kind of certainty, for example, that mathematics have with clear deductive proofs. But it does tell you how to bet. And the stronger the evidence that accumulates from multiple sources and multiple studies, you can start laying odds on this is going to be the right story, that it's actually capturing reality. And to the extent that you ignore those bets that science, I think you're going to be worse off in the decisions that you make, the way funds are allocated. If you're not betting with when science says, you know, we've got really, really good odds that the Earth is warming and it's humans, then that's the way to bet. I mean, that's been the primary attack of the deniers, is they hone in on 5%, saying you're not certain, as if certainty was something science could ever achieve in any real sense. I mean, certainly
awesome.
We can get the bet up to 99.9% in some things, like the cell theory of biology, that things are made of cells. Oh yeah, it really does look like we're made of cells, and to bet against that would be really stupid. But still, science holds all its results tentatively, so that new data and new analyses can always come in and refine the story. And a lot of times these deep things are just refining the story. They're, you know, evolution's not going to go anywhere. The idea that can be dismissed is just incorrect. It's got such a mass of positive data that the bet is really, you know, 1,000 to 1 for. And if you're going to bet on things, go with the odds. Did that make sense?
Yeah, it's terrific. Matt, go back to my throw. How comfortable are you with people, you know, who, you know, it's not grounded in the stuff that's in the peer-reviewed journal, but they'll start saying there's a sensibility that, you know, emerging or something?
I'm fine with people having issues with – I think I'm mostly just going to repeat what Stephen said. I'm fine with people having issues and regarding very skeptically what happens on the frontiers of science. You know, as you pose that question, I'm thinking of the experiment early this year, the result that there were neutrinos traveling faster than light.
Right.
And I don't want to dive too deep in this. I actually think this is an example that's very illuminating. But you have a whole lot of people who wanted to believe in this. Because theoretical physics right now is like begging for a paradigm shift. It's begging for some new result that's going to seriously falsify something so that we have some insight into where to go from here. Because in terms of its fundamentals, theoretical physics has been in sort of the same place for many, many decades. And but on the other hand, the people who reported the experiment basically said, we think this is faulty. We can't find the problem in our data. Please, guys, help us find it. And then, of course, eventually it did turn out to be false, and the speed of light remains
right.
Yeah, exactly. They found it was a problem with a cable somewhere. I don't remember
right.
the details.
Right.
And then it turned out that, you know, the speed of light, as far as we can tell, is still a fundamental speed limit. And so I'm happy with people looking at an experiment like that and saying, oh, I don't know how I'm going to treat this. But like Stephen says, let's wait for the scientific enterprise to do its thing. And although it's you know, faulty and human and has all of these caveats that we have gone to great lengths to point out, it still gives you something that you can bet on at the end of the day after enough time has progressed.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well, all is well.